Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, boy, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt. I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way. Your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it's on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad, Cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week. 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, "Shoot it!" So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarion Styles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarion can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No. Nope.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Friends, it is time once again for our daily message of hope. And with today's message, here is Richard Eaton.
Friends, to brighten your day, here is our message of hope. Do you sometimes feel sorry for yourself? Sorry for yourself because of many responsibilities? Many problems? Many unpleasant situations? Don't worry. Don't feel sorry for yourself. Happiness, serenity, even a more satisfying life will come to you in greater degree as the load you carry grows weightier. The natural way to live is under a load. As soon as a baby can walk, he wants to carry something. Ever think of that? Sometimes you may pick up a load too heavy. May get him down, may fall on top of it. But he's happy. Even then, he has something to struggle with. Under your load, you are anchored and growing. You won't drift rudderless. A ship in ballast is an easy prey to winds and waves. A cargo gives her steadiness and aids the ship to safety, helps keep a true course. Likewise, the biggest handicap for a human being is moving through life with no steadying cargo. The young man with responsibilities will survive in shifting economic seas. Without a load, he's liable to sink. A man with no responsibilities flirts with doom. He'd better pick up a load at once. The workers survive. The shirkers often sink. Abraham Lincoln scaled the magnificent summits of greatness, carrying responsibilities too heavy for most men to bear. But Lincoln's heart and soul grew until they were capable of tremendous understanding. The burdens he carried only broadened his shoulders and deepened his great sympathies and tolerance for fellow men. Under his crushing load, he was yet able to lift up a bleeding nation and carry it to peace and safety. Had no burdens been thrust upon him, the great Lincoln might well have never have attained any greatness at all. Young and old are still lifted up by heavy, useful loads. Those who refuse responsibility may grow fat, but they lose the heights of greatness. They come crashing down to valleys of despair, smashed because they carried no load. A life with no burdens is an empty life, a useless life. But differently, those who disdain burdens during youth and middle age will ultimately bear burdens they never chose. Despair, and the crushing burden of loneliness. The loads we try to avoid can often smash us. For responsibilities evaded in youth will come the regrets of old age. So when you next begin to feel sorry for yourself, to feel you bear more than your just share of burdens, stop, think, take inventories, be thankful, that God has given you the strength and courage and ability to overcome whatever problem arises to confront you. If you have many responsibilities, you're much more fortunate than the man who has none. Don't waste time envying the other man. He deserves pity, not envy. Do you find life interesting, gratifying? Or are you unhappy because there seem to be many displeasing situations in your life? You don't know how to change them. Has it ever occurred to you that what now brings heartache and disappointment, disillusion, even disgust, may perhaps actually be the growing pains of eventual progress and attainment of what you want in life? Get the habit of looking at what now seems disheartening as unpleasant simply as a growing pain. Suddenly things won't appear nearly so difficult. It's amazing. Obstacles can be turned into opportunity. Tremendous opportunity for growth and for happiness. Don't you remember your growing pains of childhood? Don't you remember that finally someone told you those pains in the legs meant you were getting bigger? Yes. And you were. At that time, wasn't the objective of getting bigger your heartest desire? Remember how all at once then the growing pains stopped? And they did. That's part of life too. Why must we take the growing pains of adult life so much more seriously than those of childhood? There's no reason for it. After all, if we take the attitude that we are stronger than any problem, that any situation contains its solution, it's tremendous the effect it does. Our whole life is changed. Yes, the way to grow toward the light is like when nature wants a man, by Angela Morgan. When nature wants to drill a man and thrill a man and skill a man. When nature wants to mold a man to play the noblest part. When she yearns with all her heart to create so great and bold a man that all the world shall praise. Watch her method, watch her ways. How she ruthlessly perfects whom she royally elects. How she hammers him and hurts him. And with mighty blows converts him into trial shapes of clay, which only nature understands. While his tortured heart is crying, and he lifts beseeching hands, how she bends but never breaks, when his good she undertakes, how she uses whom she chooses, and with every purpose fuses him, by every art induces him, to try his splendor out. Yes, nature knows what she's about. When nature wants to take a man and shake a man, wake a man. When nature wants to make a man to do the future's will, when she tries with all her skill and she yearns with all her soul to create him large and whole, with what cunning she prepares him, how she goads, never spares him, how she whets him and frets him, and in poverty begets him, how she often disappoints whom she sacredly anoints, with what wisdom she will hide him, never minding what betide him, though his genius sob with slighting, and his pride may not forget, bids him struggle harder yet, makes him lonely, so that only God's high messages shall reach him, so that she may surely teach him what the hierarchy planned, though he may not understand, gives him passions to command, how remorselessly she spurs him, with terrific ardor stirs him, when she poignantly prefers him. Yes, when nature wants to shame a man and fame a man and tame a man, when nature wants to shame a man to do his heavenly best, when she tries the highest test that her reckoning may bring, when she reins him and constrains him so his body scarce contains him, while she fires him and inspires him, keeps him yearning, ever burning for a tantalizing goal, lures and lacerates his soul, sets the challenge for his spirit, draws it higher when he's near it, makes a jungle that he clear it, makes a desert that he fear it, and subdue it if he can. So doth nature make a man, then to test his spirit's wrath, hurls a mountain in his path, puts a bitter choice before him, climb or perish, so she says, Watch her purpose, watch her ways. Nature's plan is wondrous kind. Could we understand her mind? Fools are they who call her blind. When his feet are torn and bleeding, and his highest powers speeding, blazing newer paths and fine. Yes, when the force that is divine leaps to challenge every failure, and his ardor still is sweet, and love and hope are burning in the presence of defeat, lo the crisis, lo the shout that must call the leader out. When the people need salvation, doth he come to lead the nation? Thus doth nature show her plan, when the world has found a man. Yes, let me repeat some of this poem, which shows so clearly how important are the loads we bear, how necessary to the growth of our soul. When nature wants to drill a man and thrill a man and skill a man, when nature wants to mold a man to play the noblest part, when she yearns with all her heart to create so great and bold a man that all the world shall praise, watch her method, watch her ways, how she ruthlessly perfects whom she royally elects, how she hammers him and hurts him, and with mighty blows converts him to trial shapes of clay, which only nature understands. While his tortured heart is crying, he lifts beseeching hands, how she bends but never breaks. When his good she undertakes, how she uses whom she chooses, as every purpose fuses him, by every art induces him to try his splendor out. Nature knows what she's about. When nature wants to take a man and shake a man and wake a man, when nature wants to make a man to do the future's will, when she tries with all her skill, she yearns with all her soul to create him large and whole. With what cunning she prepares him, how she goads and never spares him, how she whets him and frets him, and poverty begets him, how she often disappoints whom she sacredly anoints, with what wisdom she will hide him, never minding what betide him, though his genius sob with slighting, and his pride may not forget. Bids him struggle harder yet, makes him lonely, so that only God's high messages shall reach him, so that she may surely teach him what the hierarchy planned. Though he may not understand, gives him passions to command, how remorselessly she spurs him, with terrific ardor stirs him, when she poignantly prefers him. Yes, when nature wants to shame a man, and fame a man, and tame a man, when nature wants to shame a man to do his heavenly best, when she tries the highest test that her reckoning may bring, when she reins him and constrains him, so his body scarce contains him, while she fires him and inspires him, keeps him yearning, ever burning for a tantalizing goal, lures and lacerates his soul, sets a challenge for his spirit, draws it higher when he's near it, makes a jungle that he clear it, makes a desert that he fear it, and subdue it if he can. So doth nature make a man, then to test his spirit's wrath, hurls the mountain in his path, puts a bitter choice before him, climb or perish, so she says. Watch her purpose, watch her ways. Nature's plan is wondrous kind, could we understand her mind. Fools are they who call her blind, when his feet are torn and bleeding, yet his highest powers speeding, blazing newer paths and finer. When the force that is divine leaps to challenge every failure, and his ardor still is sweet, and love and hope are burning in the presence of defeat, lo the crisis, lo the shout that must call the leader out. When the people need salvation, doth he come to lead the nation. Thus doth nature show her plan, when the world has found a man. And every one of us is that man. Friends, you've been listening once again to our message of hope. God bless you, everyone.
Listen again tomorrow, friends, for another message of hope with Richard Eaton. This is UBC, the United Broadcasting Company.
Okay. Man, quiet in here today. Jump off topic of the Great Migration 2023. Of course, if you guys got any topic that you want to discuss, please bring it forth, 619-768-2945. Okay, wait a minute here. All right, well, okay, let's play. So you guys got to wake up on me.
Good afternoon. It is a real great honor for me today to share my story with you. I'm really honored. As they have already said, I'm William Kankwamba. I'm from Malawi. If you are not familiar with where Malawi is in southeast Africa, bordered by Mozambique, Zambia, and Tanzania. Geographically, that's where Malawi is. A little big background of my invention, what I did when I was young. I grown up in the family of 7 children. They are all sisters, excepting me. So you can imagine, growing up with girls, life wasn't too easy for me. Especially at school, sometimes my fellow colleague, they'll say, if I have food or a banana, they say, like, give us your banana. When I try to resist, say, I need to eat it, they say, like, we are going to beat you up. You don't have elder brother to protect you. So most of the time, I was just giving them my banana. Anyway, I survived from them. So Malawi is more of like agricultural country. Many people depend on farming. We grow our own food, and we also grow some crops for selling to get cash. As being farmers, even my parents are also farmers. But most of the farmers are not farmers by choice, but they are farmers because of the circumstances that they are in. Most of them, they are farmers because they didn't go to school. So that's the only job that they're going to do, is to farm, to grow their own food when it is rain season. Being a farmer, it's really a difficult job, and it needs so much of things in order to be successful a farmer. There are a lot of things that makes farming a little tough and can make farming go wrong. Some of the things are the price of seeds, the price of fertilizer, or the weather itself. As many people in my community, they depend on the land to grow their food. So weather is very crucial to their farming. In 2001, we experienced one of these 3 problems. We didn't have enough rain. We had a drought. As a result, many people harvested only a quarter amount of food what they were hoping to harvest at that particular year. So you can imagine that people are hoping to grow food that they're going to last them for the entire year. Until the next harvesting season, they only harvested a quarter amount of wheat. And as a result, there was a famine in the country. Many people were starving to death. Including my family, was badly affected by the situation. So, that time, many people grow up maize, which we grind to make our main food. We call it nsima. You can eat together with vegetables or fish if you have money to buy fish. So because of the situation, many people didn't have enough of wheat that can last them for the entire year, and people starting starving. And the situation was really bad in the rural areas. So the only maize that people were getting, they were getting maize at the market, which was imported from our neighboring country, Tanzania. But it was so expensive for people to buy it because the vendors took advantage of the situation. They were doubling the price of the maize at the market. So at that particular time, it was also the same time that I was supposed to start my high school. In Malawi, high school, you have to pay for it, while primary school is for free. Because of the situation, my parents couldn't afford to pay for my education. So I was forced to drop out of school. When I had to drop out of school, I looked at my father, and looking at all the dry fields, it was the future I couldn't accept. I didn't want to become like him. I didn't want to become a farmer. It is not that I didn't want to become a farmer because I hate farming. No, I love farming. But I didn't want to become a farmer because that's the only thing that I can do with my life. I wanted to live the life that I can be able to determine what I want to do at a particular time, and I can be able to do anything else that I need to do, not being limited because of the education that I got. So for me, there was only one thing that I needed to do in order to continue up with my studies and my dream of becoming something different from the rest of the people in my community who just get into the same cycle of becoming a farmer, not by choice. So for me, I decided to start going to the library to read books. I was hoping that by the time when the famine will be over, my parents will find money and they will send me back to school, I shouldn't be very behind from the rest of the students who were going to school at that time. So at the library, I read different books. I was reading physics books, even though at that particular time, I couldn't read English that well. I was most of the time using diagrams and pictures to learn the words around them. One thing that inspired me to start reading most of science books and trying to understand how different things work was that when I was much younger, I was so curious to see how radios work. I thought that maybe inside the radio, there are small, tiny people who speak. One day, my parents went away. I finally sneaked in. I took the radio. I opened it inside. I was so surprised to see very tiny things that looks like beans. I was like, are these people? How can I tell if these are people? Say, that's not a big deal. I should just twist one of it. If there are people, they will be screaming like, leave us alone. When I tried to twist a little hard, nothing happened. So from there, I started removing one component after another to try to see what is happening. So at the same library, I also found this book which had a picture of the windmill. When I opened inside, they say windmills could pump water and generate electricity. The word pump water attracted my attention because at that time, we were still going through this theme, and I was thinking that if I can be able to build a windmill to pump water, I can be able to start irrigation, growing food 2 to 3 times a year instead of only 1 time a year, then I can solve the problem that we are facing in my family or in my community. But there was a challenge to do so because at that time, I didn't have money to buy materials to build a windmill to pump water. So I ended up going to the junkyard, which was just next to my former high school. When I went there, a lot of people were laughing at me, including my mom. She thought that you are no longer going to get married. No one is going to want to marry a crazy man. So some people are thinking that maybe I'm smoking weed. That's what is making me to be collecting all the junk. People are saying that normal person cannot be collecting all the garbage and putting them together, saying that it's building a machine that we have never seen and we don't know about it. So for me, I understand them. But regardless of what they were saying, I didn't stop from doing what I wanted to do because I knew that once if this windmill exists somewhere else, somebody built it, and if it's a human being who built it, there's nothing that can stop me from doing the same thing. I can also do the same thing that other people have already been done. This is not something that is new. It's innovation that has already been done somewhere else. So I collected all the pieces that I needed for my windmill, which including getting the tractor fan, which I use as the load of my windmill, finding like shock absorber, using the PVC pipes, putting everything together, I was able to build the windmill. So a lot of people, when I did this, build the windmill, a lot of people were coming up to see it, what I have done. And some people were asking me, what is this machine all about? I'll tell them that this is the windmill can generate power. Some people in my community had cell phones, and they were bringing in their cell phone. They say, can it charge a cell phone? I say, yeah, it can charge a cell phone. They say, let's try. When I try and it shows that the cell phone is charging, I say, like, your cell phone is charging. Now you believe me. Can you take your cell phone? They say, no. I won't believe you. I'll believe you if my phone will be fully charged. So I was just leaving them to charge their cell phone using my windmill. So there was also like some other things that I had to do after I was able to build this windmill so that I can be able to use the power quite well. One of the things was to build light switch, because I didn't have money to buy a proper switch. I had to build it by myself and also build a circuit breaker so that in case of emergency where the wires cross together, it can be able to shut down the system so that my house doesn't burn from the electricity getting close together. So after I was able to achieve this, I didn't stop going to the library. And one day, the librarian asked me, why do you always check out the same book all the time? I explained to her that the book has helped me to build the windmill, which generates power in my community. And she was interested to come and see by herself. When she came, she reported to the people who donated the book, and they also came to see by themselves at my house. When they saw it, they went back, and they came again with some journalists who wrote an article about my story. And that article was picked up by one of the guys who was organizing the TED conference, and then I was invited to attend the TED conference. At that time, I have never been away from being away from my country. And then when I heard the story that I'll be going there by plane, like enough, people in my village advised me. They say, son, we heard that you are going up to this journey. Make sure that the night before your flight, don't eat. I say, well, why shouldn't I eat? They say, if you eat, you are going to vomit in the plane. I didn't eat that night. But when I was in the plane, I was so surprised that they were giving us food. I almost refused, like, no. My people in my village already told me that if I'll eat, I'll vomit. If you want to embarrass me, don't embarrass me. So anyway, people were just saying without little, like, knowing. So at the conference, I spoke very briefly, and people came up to me. How can we help you to achieve your goals? So my goal at the beginning was to build a windmill to pump water, not to build a windmill to generate electricity. So I told them I want to continue with the building more windmills that I can also be able to pump water for irrigation. So they were able to help me to get some materials that I needed, and I was able to go back and build this windmill which pumps water for my mom's vegetable garden, and also use the water for other sanitation at the house. And I was also able to go back to school. I went to school in South Africa for 2 years for high school. After 2 years, I graduated, and now I'm attending Dartmouth College. So there were a lot of things that we kind of like did. I did after the conference. One of the things was to start up organization which is trying to build a primary school that I went to in Malawi. The school was built almost 50 years ago with the capacity of 400 students. The time when I was going there were 2,000 students. Right now, there are 1,400 students, and the classes are in terrible condition. So we are trying to rebuild it so that the students, they're going to be able to study in a good environment. So the summer of 2010, we were able to build one school. And I went back there to build more windmills to generate power for the school. But I wasn't doing that only by myself. I tried to recruit some other students from the school so that I can also share with them my skills. They can learn how to build their windmills so that I can be able to build for themselves or for their families so that many people in my country can also be able to have a chance to access to electricity as well. So right now, at that time, we are able to build this windmill which generates electricity, including we put up a hybrid system together with solar panels, and then students, they're going to be able now to power the school. They're going to be able to study at night, and they can also be able to power one laptop per child so that they can just have like some basic ideas of how computers work and how other things work. So right now, for me, I'm also right now attending this Dartmouth College, which I'm planning to do to study environmental studies and combine also with some engineering as well. When I look back into my journey, starting from the point when I started until where I am right now, I've gone through like so many like challenges. But one thing that kind of like encouraged me, that kept me going even in the time when most people were doubting of what I was doing, it was that I was able to trust myself and I believe in myself that I can still do it regardless of what other people were saying. One thing that inspired me a lot to do what I did, I can say it's also my grandmother. In Malawi, there's this division of job. They say there's job for female and job for male. One of the jobs that is considered to be male's job is to make bricks to build your house. They consider that that's a real tough job that most women cannot do. But my grandmother, she was able to do it by her own self. So a lot of people were asking her, why are you making bricks by yourself instead of your husband? The answer that she was responding to them, it was quite inspiring to me to say, when your jacket caught fire, you don't wait for somebody to put it off, because you are the one who can start feeling the fire, and you are the one who can start putting off the fire. So she was referring that if you are in trouble, you are the one who can know your troubles, and you are the one who can start trying to find the solution to get out of that trouble. And other people might see you that you are in trouble, and they can come along to help you to pull off from the trouble that you are in. So for me, with that, I was like thinking that if I'm in trouble, I still need to do something in order to get myself out of that trouble. So when I saw myself in that situation, I thought that I shouldn't wait for some other people to help me, but I should start, and other people might come along to help me doing what I want to do. That's why I was able to achieve what I achieved. So lastly, I would just like to share with you that sometime in life, we face so many challenges that can simply stop us from achieving what we want to achieve. Regardless of where you are and who you are, at some point you are going to face some challenges. Although the challenges might be different from what somebody else might face from some other part of the world, but it will still some challenges that can simply stop you from achieving what you want to achieve. I will challenge you that those challenges are not there to stop you to achieve what you want to achieve, but are there to strengthen you from what you want to achieve, and you can still like do it. All the people that we have heard, like all these people like have been speaking like today, they have lived like successful story business. At some point, if you ask them, they faced some challenges, but they didn't allow those challenges to stop them from achieving what they achieved until they were able to do what they are able to do. So everything in this world, I'll just say that it's possible and you can still do it, everything that you want. Thank you for allowing me to share my story with you today.
Okay, it's quiet, man, today. So we were going to discuss the Great Migration 2023. We'll hold it over for another day, another time. But because there's migration happening in the U.S. and you know, people moving from different states, different cities, or whatever. All motivated, well, different reasons, but a lot of them are economic. So, all right, well, let's see, what can, all right, you guys are mighty quiet, so, or if you're there at all. All right, well, let's see. I don't want to shut it down just yet. Well, let's go with Solo.
Liberals have wreaked more havoc on blacks than the supposed legacy of slavery they talk about.
Yes.
You don't mean that hyperbolically.
No, I do not.
There can be no realization of the American dream without grappling with the original sin of slavery.
The effects of slavery and Jim Crow didn't suddenly vanish in the 60s.
We wonder why there's so many socioeconomic, there's such a socioeconomic gap now between black people and white people. It's because of that.
History has been written, but it's been written to tell us a certain story. And the 1619 Project is trying to reframe that story. And it's really about the ongoing legacy of slavery.
Liberals have wreaked more havoc on blacks than the supposed legacy of slavery they talk about.
Yes.
You don't mean that hyperbolically.
No, I do not.
They've made it difficult to get jobs, to get started in the job market. Minimum wage law would be one of those things, but only one.
We have a real battle in this country around minimum wage and the need to increase minimum wage.
The single most rapid and important thing that we can do to deal with wage inequity and start this virtuous cycle is what the governor did today, raising the minimum wage.
Outside of economics, most people, even most faculty members at leading universities, have no conception of the minimum wage. They simply think, you know, it'll raise the pay of people at the bottom, and that's a good thing. Well, what it really does is that it prices low-skilled, inexperienced people out of a job.
The terrible schooling would be a major factor. That if you're going to turn out kids who are 40% functionally illiterate upon graduation from high school, then you're going to have very serious problems in the job market.
Detroit schools are a failure. There's no way to argue against that.
90% of students in Detroit public schools, eighth graders, are not proficient in math or reading.
Detroit Public Schools Community District. It received the poorest grade for a second year in a row after a national report card was revealed overnight.
They're doing many things to make it much tougher for the person at the bottom to get started. And they're also making it less necessary to get started by having various subsidy programs, food stamps, welfare, and so on, which reduce the difference between working and not working.
Centuries of slavery, generations of Jim Crow did not destroy the black family. But one generation of the welfare state did.
In 1960, which would be almost 100 years after the end of slavery,
right,
22% of black kids grew up in homes with only one parent. 30 years later, after the liberal welfare state, that number had more than tripled. And so I say, well, let us compare, if we can speculate on how much that 22% was due to the legacy of slavery. But we know that that tripling was not due to the legacy of slavery. It was due to the legacy of a whole different set of policies.
Most black kids, even under slavery, had lived with two parents. And that was true all the way up until the 1960s.
If you look at the poverty rate among blacks, it was 22%. And among whites, it was 11%. But among black married couples, it was 7.5%.
Right.
So it's not, so they not only do better than blacks as a whole, they do better than whites as a whole.
And black married couples
have had a poverty rate in single digits every year since 1994. I don't think it's the marriage as such or the library cards as such. It's that there are lifestyle choices that have been made. And you can look at it so many other ways. As of 1940, 87% of black households were in poverty. Over the next 20 years, that declined to 47%. This is all prior to the civil rights laws, prior to the social welfare policies of the Johnson administration. Over the next 20 years, it fell an additional 18 points. But that was just the same trend continuing at a reduced rate. Affirmative action is even worse. Poverty rate was something like 30% among black households before affirmative action. And a decade after affirmative action, it was 29%. This is not the same as the 40% decline that occurred before there were any civil rights laws and before there was any social welfare state. The homicide victimization rate among black males in the decade of the 1940s declined by 18%. From 1950 to 1960, it declined another 22%. And then in the 1960s, when all these wonderful new ideas in the criminal justice system came in, all of that reversed. And it shot up 89% in one decade, wiping out all the progress of the two preceding decades.
The same mindset that has created the welfare state, the same non-judgmental philosophy, has also led to a great deal of leniency toward criminals. And so you have runaway crime and people are living in fear.
And you can run through a whole bunch of other things like that.
So if you look at what actually happens in the wake of these wonderful sounding policies, you see disaster after disaster. And I think many people who were gung-ho for the idea that this is going to be progress simply cannot bring themselves to look at the evidence and say, my God, we made things worse.
The typical black family in this country has one-tenth the wealth of the typical white family.
And when we look around us, we can see that although we have changes since the civil rights movement and we have this idea of racism being bad, we still have the same unequal outcomes by race. By every measure, we have racial inequality.
The average black household has approximately $800,000 less in net worth than the average white household. Indeed, it's very important to note that the major factor that dictates what an individual or a family's level of wealth is the transfer of resources across generations, which means in turn that wealth captures the cumulative intergenerational effects of white supremacy in the United States.
There's a tendency for intellectuals to go for one-factor explanations. And in point of fact, there are so many different factors that it's virtually impossible that there could be any such thing as equal outcomes for different groups. The more you look into either people or nature, you find disparities everywhere, all over the world, and all kinds of things.
The differences between income between Western Europeans and Eastern Europeans is greater than the difference between blacks and whites in the United States.
You note that from country to country, there are a lot of disparities in wealth, and many of them are extreme. The per capita GDP of China is less than one-fourth that of Japan. That of India is barely 10% of that of Japan, and you offer a number of comparisons like that.
I can come up with umpteen different examples of this disparities in various situations. People on the other side cannot give you one example. You can read reams of paper by advocates of social justice and not find one example anywhere in the world. There are people who have done international studies. Braudel, I quote, the French historian, he said, in no society has all parts of the population had the same outcomes. You don't have to look for a boogeyman to explain why everybody's not making the same money or having the same wealth.
Intellectuals give people who have the handicap of poverty
the further handicap of a sense of victimhood.
Intellectuals have no interest in what creates wealth and what inhibits the creation of wealth. They are very concerned about the distribution of it, but they act as if wealth just exists somehow. And it's only a question, it's like manna from heaven. It's only a question of how we split it up.
And why should that be? Why shouldn't they find that question at least intellectually fascinating?
Because it would destroy the whole vision that they have. It would say there are enormous numbers of reasons why people acquire the ability to create wealth. And they vary all over the world. And so if you find, for example, that in centuries past, Germans living in Eastern Europe had much higher standards of living than the indigenous peoples of Eastern Europe. Intellectuals will say, well, the Germans have somehow oppressed the people of Eastern Europe.
Right.
Or the ones who are into genetic determinism will say the Germans were born biologically superior to the people of Eastern Europe. But anyone with a knowledge of history would know that there are all kinds of reasons why Western Europe as a whole has far greater wealth producing capacity than Eastern Europe. But of course, that would then cut out the role of intellectuals.
You write that although intellectuals pay a lot of attention to inequalities among racial and ethnic groups, quote, seldom has this attention been directed toward how the less economically successful might improve themselves by availing themselves of the culture of others around them, close quote. What do you mean by that?
I mean that the same things which allow some other people to prosper can allow them to prosper if they take advantage of those same things. The Scots were a classic example. They were one of the poorest and most ignorant people on the fringes of European civilization in centuries past. But once they, for whatever reasons, began to educate themselves and especially to learn the English language, which became a passion, people all over Scotland, including Hume himself, were taking lessons in the English language. And from about the middle of the 18th century to the middle of the 19th century, the leading intellectuals in Britain were Scots.
Right.
I mean, you had Adam Smith in economics, Hume in human philosophy, Black in chemistry. You go through the whole list. And so they could do that. But that was an extremely rare thing for an intellectual to say. Most intellectuals in most countries around the world see the issue as how those who are more prosperous should be brought down. Rather than how, and moreover, the people who are lagging should cling to their culture. I don't know how you're going to keep on doing what you've always done and get results that are different from what you've always gotten.
Asheville, North Carolina became the very first city in the South and only the second in the nation to formally approve financial restitution for Black residents. This week, California made history. On Wednesday, Governor Gavin Newsom signed a first-of-its-kind law forming a task force to study the state's role in slavery and make recommendations for reparations.
The sad fact is that slavery has been a universal institution for thousands of years, as far back as you can trace human history. Archaeological finds suggest that slavery existed before human beings could read and write. A racial difference between the slaves and the enslavers, that is a relatively new phenomenon. You didn't have in ancient times the ability to go to another continent and move millions of people across, of a different race across the ocean. So you enslaved the people who were nearby. The Europeans enslaved Slavs for centuries before they brought the first Black African to the Western Hemisphere. As much as slavery is repudiated around the world today, prior to the 18th century, I know of no serious effort to abolish the institution anywhere.
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 Not in Africa, not in the Arabian world.
Not in Africa in the 21st century. Even in the antebellum South, most whites did not have slaves. The cost of one male adult slave was more than the average white person earned all year. So they weren't all living in terror with their plantations and all the rest of it. And what we're looking at is if slavery is something that happened to one race of people in one country, when in fact the spread of it was around the world. In 1776, which is when Adam Smith published The Wealth of Nations, as well as when the United States got started, he said that Western Europe is the only place in the world where there is no slavery. And even the Western Europeans had vast numbers of slaves in the Western Hemisphere,
yes,
but not in Western Europe itself. And so if you're going to have reparations for slavery, it's going to be the greatest transfer of wealth back and forth and between and cross hauling, as they say in the railroads, because the number of whites, for example, who were enslaved in North Africa by the Barbary pirates, exceeded the number of Africans enslaved in the United States and in the American colonies before that, put together. But nobody is going to North Africa to ask for reparations because nobody is going to be fool enough to give it to them. Here we have intellectuals who can imagine a different history from the rest of the world, even though it's so similar to the rest of the world.
America, here's the deal. There are people who actually use their brains, who take the time to actually do research. The Commons of the world, the John Legends of the world, the Kerry Washingtons of the world. You see what Snoop is out there doing. Shaq has now talked about voting for the first time. He did an event the other day for the Biden campaign. And here's my deal. Lil Wayne, if you want to endorse Donald Trump, go ahead. But don't sit here and think we stupid, Erica, by saying that the Platinum Plan is going to help black people. How in the hell is something one page? One page.
You know. Because
the first sheet ain't nothing but a cover sheet. Okay? And I said it. Lil Wayne, don't go on ESPN. Don't go on Fox Sports. Bring your ass here and talk to black people, and let's go over line by line. See, here's my challenge to you, Lil Wayne. Since you sat down with Donald Trump, bring your ass here with no codeine, no purple drink, and I'm going to go line by line. We're going to start with the top line. We're going to start with the top line, Lil Wayne. And we're going to go line by line. And I want you to explain to black people how Trump's so-called platinum plan is going to help black people. Line by line, Lil Wayne. Now, I advise you to read that damn thing first. Because what you don't want to do, Erica, you don't want to come over here with a long-ass pause when I hit you with a question.
It's time to be smart. When we control our institutions, we win. This is the most important news show on television of any racial background. Y'all put $2, $3, $4, $5, $10, $15, $20, $30 on this and keep this going. What you've done, Roland, since this crisis came out in full bloom. Anybody watching this, tell your friends. Go back and look at the last 2 weeks, especially of Roland Martin Unfiltered. I mean, hell, go back and look at the last 2 days. You've had sitting United States senators today, Klobuchar and Harris. Whatever you have that you have, you can bring to Roland Martin Unfiltered to support it. Please do, because this information may literally save your life.
Watch Roland Martin Unfiltered.
Did you prime it? That little rubber ball right there next to the spark plug. Got to push it in 3 times before you try to start it. Gets the gas going to the car.
You want the truth? I ain't never used one of these. Never had no call to.
Yeah, well, I didn't pick you up for your landscaping skills. All these Spanish, they on paper too. Only use people like y'all. Sometimes it comes back on and sometimes it works out fine.
Well, how long you been uptown?
10 years.
Hotter than a motherfucker out here.
Yeah, it's hot. Every day. You're going to be riding in the back of that hard truck, bouncing around every day. And your back's going to be yelling at you every day. I used to drive an SL, pretty gold convertible, nice rims. I don't even think on that car no more.
You put it behind you, huh?
Some can't. I'm just saying, you want to stay on the street. Ain't going to be no big reward to it. This is it, right here. Prime that bitch 3 times. She'll start right up.
Different days for different ways, different streets for different weeks. If you just
partida
means right on, brother, and right on, sister. Anyway, learned it in Hawaii.
Now it's time to do some wailing. Come on and dance with me. Nothing is a game and failing. So come on and dance with me.
Yeah.
All right. That's slight technical difficulty. All right. The Great Migration, that's just something quick for me this morning. The Great Migration in 23, if you look on YouTube, and YouTube is one of my favorite barometers, you've got a lot of movement around the planet, but we're talking about the United States real quick. There's one guy on there that I was watching this morning. He's come up with a term for this migration throughout the United States, and that's essentially people moving from place to place for whatever reason. But it's a combination of America and California. Amerifornia, that's it, Amerifornia. And Amerifornia, if you look it up on YouTube, the guy who coined the term, you have people that are, I think, 700 out of California, maybe within the last year or two. You have people that particularly certain cities. Now, you've got 19,500 municipalities around the United States. And only 10 of them have a population within the city itself of 10. 10 cities out of that 19,500 municipalities. And that's, you know, like New York City, Chicago, Los Angeles, Dallas, Texas, Houston, Texas, San Antonio, Texas. Texas has three cities in that top 10. And California has three. They've got L.A., San Diego, let's look that up right now. I want to say San Jose or San Francisco. Let's see, top 10. Populated. Okay, top 10 populated cities in the United States. They are New York, Houston, Philadelphia. Oh, man. That's not the list I'm looking for. Okay. Top 10 populated cities in the United States. All right, the 10 most popular, that's in the world. I don't want that. 10 largest U.S. cities. Okay, you've got New York City with 8.5 million. So people are moving out of New York City. Los Angeles, 3.9 million people moving out of L.A. And you may as well put the metro areas too. Okay, Chicago, 2.37. Houston, Texas. Phoenix, Arizona, Philadelphia, San Antonio, Texas, San Diego, California, Dallas, Texas, and San Jose, California. So California's got San Jose, San Diego, and Los Angeles. And in these cities, these top 10 cities and metro areas, matter of fact, let's even talk a little bit. 10 public metro areas, okay. All right, we have I don't want to say that we just did that. 10 largest metro. Let's see. Okay, largest metro areas. New York is number one. Los Angeles number two. Chicago number three. Dallas number four. Dallas-Fort Worth number four. Houston, Woodlands, and Sugar Land, Texas number five. Washington, Arlington, D.C. metro area, DMV, and they rank number six as far as metro areas, over 6 million people. Miami, Fort Lauderdale, Pompano Beach, they rank number seven. Philadelphia, Camden, Wilmington, Atlanta, Phoenix, Mesa, Chandler, Arizona, Boston. Oh, we just, you know, let's just stick with. Well, all right, Boston, number 11, San Francisco, number 12, St. Louis comes in at number 20, Baltimore, Columbia, Towson, number 21, Kissimmee, Florida, and Orlando, number 12. This goes down to 30, which is Austin, Texas. Had to get a swig of water. Here's what I know. Let's take the number 15. Seattle, Tacoma, Bellevue, Washington. People are, matter of fact, All right, so I'll go down to. Number 15. All right, you got Seattle, Washington, Seattle, Tacoma, Bellevue, Washington, 4-15. Now, they have Detroit, Michigan in here, but that's questionable here. But these are cities that, particularly the top, you need to be wealthy to live in these places. And depending on the city and neighborhood within these metro areas, you need to be rich. So you have a migration of people of different socioeconomic backgrounds, races, and all that are moving out of a lot of these places. Now, there are plenty of places for them to go. You know, now, once again, the primary barometer that I use is would be YouTube, number one, Census Bureau, number two. And it practically go hand in hand. Then I'm big on maps, too, specialized maps. You got people living in cars voluntarily. Some live involuntarily. You have people that are converting vans into tiny houses on wheels. You have a lot of people that are camping. They are nomads. They're digital nomads. You have travel vloggers who are YouTubers. There's a lot of them. There's a whole bunch of them that travel around the world doing YouTube videos. And they earn a living from it, sustainable living. And the common denominator with a lot of these nomads and digital nomads and the people that are building tiny houses and micro houses, Some of the primary common denominators I'm finding out is, number one, they don't have a mortgage to pay. They're not obligated to pay anybody for 30 years. Number two, many of them do not have student loans. Some do, but many don't. Number three, car notes. You know, if you go out here and buy a brand new car, it might be $15,000, $20,000, $25,000, $30,000. That could be $30,000 sitting in your driveway or garage, wherever you might park it. So a lot of them don't have that mortgage debt settled on them, and that's why they're able to move and do what they do. So a lot of people have been moving, depending on the demographic that you're talking about. Matter of fact, let me look in my notes. And, okay, I have something here about, well, I read it, and I don't have it in my notes here. But you have a number of black folks who were born and raised up north, but they're relocating back to southern states. Just, what, 2 days ago on here, we had Angela Griffin. You know, she lives in Orlando, but, you know, she picks up property in different part, about seven different states in the United States, where she bought six houses in Gary, Indiana for $3,600. All right. Now, they need work. They need work. But her plan is to essentially, I mean, first thing before I even get to her plans on it, there's some people, like if you live in the D.C. area, DMV, New York City, Chicago, Los Angeles, San Diego, San Jose, you have some people in this country that's their rent payment on a monthly basis, $3,600. Or even if they're paying $600 a month rent, let's go with that, or even $500 a month rent. Within 10 months, they put out $5,000, you know, so she bought 36 houses at $600, six houses at $600 each, no mortgage, all right? She's got them boarded up, and she's going to renovate them, and that's going to be part of her retirement plan that she controls. The government doesn't have anything to do with that. That's her personal Social Security. Those six houses, and I mean, she's probably got more than that, I'm sure. But I'm just saying, that's something that she controls. She doesn't have to wait on the government or get government approval on that. Now, she lives in the Central Florida area. And, you know, she, as she explained on Monday, was it, you know, she's Indiana, various parts of Indiana. So you've got, she's made it so where she doesn't have to move to another city on a permanent basis, but she goes to other cities virtually and in person to pick up things. Now, Orlando wasn't in the top 20 cities I just named, I think. But most people will achieve it. Whatever you earn in a year, you're going to have to be thinking about how can you earn that on a monthly basis. Let me see. Let me go back to my program notes here. But there is a migration going on, including black folks. And I know of a couple that were moving, black couple that was, they were living in West Palm Beach, Florida, in that area. They bought 40 acres in Montana. Another black couple that I saw on YouTube, they bought 25 to 28 acres in New Mexico. No, plenty of water. No water bill. I mean, you know, they have a homestead there. 3 months ago, we interviewed three ladies from the Freedom Georgia Initiative. So that's where the ball is going. You have people that are saying, I mean, they're going, you have a lot of people that are going from struggling in Atlanta to moving to some place like New Mexico. Now you got to move to the right place in New Mexico or the right place in Arizona, or the right place in Texas. But there are plenty of right places out of 19,500 municipalities in the United States. They're moving to the right places and adopting an off-the-grid lifestyle where their expenses are, like, very low. Like I said, they don't get a light bill. They don't get a water bill. They're escaping municipal services. So there is, you might not call it a mass exodus, but no less, there's an exodus out of your larger cities. They're going up. Many people are moving to unincorporated communities where, you know, with unincorporated, you know, you're getting the expenses of larger municipalities that have, you know, taxes and all that. Now, there's little bitty municipalities where the taxes are reasonable. So you just have to, and they're out there in abundance, like I say. Once you get past, here's what I go by. The larger the city, the larger the community, okay, you're going to have more rules and regulations. And the larger your population base, you're going to be paying for those municipal services. If you want to live in a city that has a police force, and most police forces are unionized, that's expensive. You, as a taxpayer living in that city, you got to pay for that. The larger, like New York City, okay, there's a bunch of people in New York City. I don't know what the number is, but they're on social services. Social programs are expensive. All right? There are people out there that want reparations. Now, it seems like places like, Asheville, North Carolina, they're discussing it on the city level. There's a city, I forget the name, not Harvey, Illinois, but somewhere up there near Chicago and Harvey. I think they already passed the reparations bill on a local city level. Who's going to pay for that? It's not going to be the state of Illinois. It's not going to be coming from the federal government. It's going to be coming from the taxpayers who live in that particular community. Now, I understand that California is about to pass or looking at California wasn't even a slave state. But you got people out there that are trying to get something in California for reparations. So I don't know what that's going to look like. But I had to clear my throat. I look at reparations as a social program. Social programs are expensive. So those who want them, fine. But in any event, there is a migration going on. People leaving California to go to various places. People leaving New York City to go, you know, a bunch of them have gone to Delaware. Some of them come down here to Florida. Then you have, now this is just my personal opinion. On a critical mass basis, the majority of cities where you have the highest black populations in the United States are really not the best places for black folks to live. In my opinion, on a critical mass basis, if you're a black person, you really need to consider leaving. If you're in New York, I think you need to consider your options in New York State. Not in Buffalo. Now, I'm not talking about Buffalo going to other urban areas in the state, like Buffalo, Niagara Falls, and Rochester. I'm talking about looking at rural New York State. If you're living in Chicago, I suggest that you look at the rural counties of Illinois and also see what's happening in Iowa, Wisconsin, Indiana, as well as Ohio to the east. if you're in Florida, like if you live in some place like Fort Lauderdale, Miami, Orlando, Tampa, I suggest you look at the rural counties of Florida. Get away from the highly dense. I'm just saying. If you're in California, look at the rural counties of California. But take a look up there in Northern California. Or another place in California, the southeastern part of the state of California. If you're in Arizona, I suggest you look at New Mexico. Or if you're going to stay in the state of Arizona, look at places, look at counties that have a lower population than Phoenix, Mesa, Scottsdale, Lake Havasu. Those look at places where you know you can pick up some land on the cheap. Now, as far as skills go, many of you, or I should say many of us, because I'm included, need to pick up some new skills. Now, STEM, and I'm about to stop my rant and go to the phone lines. Okay. STEM, which stands for, let's see, let me get it right, get it completely right. STEM, okay. STEM, STEM, is an acronym that stands for science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. All right. Science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Now, the word science, which means knowledge, it's a broad bunch. I mean, because that we can talk about anything from biology to medicine. And then within biology and medicine, there's marine biology, all different types of medicines and all, you know, nursing school and all that. Technology, that's a big word too. Engineering, mathematics. And, you know, there's the STEM majors where, matter of fact, let me look at STEM majors. That's if you're going to go the college route or you decide to go back to college and pick up some degree. Here we go. Computer science, and then there's subsets to computer science. Engineering, there's subsets to engineering. Mathematics, there's subsets to that. Biology, which you can get into ecology, genetics, zoology, and botany, as well as many others. You have physics, and there's a lot of ways you can go with physics. Computer engineering, mechanical engineering, chemistry, science, biomedical engineering, electrical engineering. I had a friend of mine. He was an EE major, electrical engineering major, rocket scientist, went to work for Hughes Aircraft, but he was living out in L.A., Los Angeles, California, but married with the kids, and although he was getting a big paycheck, he eventually lost his home in foreclosure and the marriage was complete and all that. So there's a lot of things with this. I'm suggesting, okay, there's nothing wrong with looking at those STEM professions. I'm suggesting if you're going to do that, you also need to look at picking up what I consider off-the-grid skills. Now, one of the off-the-grid skills that I recommend that you can be anything you want to be now, rocket scientist to whatever, basketball player, whatever. But in addition to whatever STEM skills that you might want to get or whatever piece of paper or new skill you want to pick up, fundamentally, I think you should have number one skill, learn how to build a cabin at least, an off-the-grid dry cabin at the bare minimum. because you'll be able to have a roof over your head anywhere you go around the globe, and you can earn money from that. So it's just like if you got the skill to wipe yourself after taking a bowel movement, okay, this is another, that's a life skill. This is another basic fundamental one-on-one life skill. If you don't have it, I think you should pick it up. Life skill number two, no pun intended. Life skill number two is learn how to drill for water. Life skill number two. That's very important. Because water virtually is life itself. Now, in some places, due to law, you won't be able to drill for water. In some places, but in many places, if you know how to drill for water and where to drill for water, you'll be all right. Now, if drilling for water, if let's say once you learn that life skill, all right, if you can't, you know, and you decide, all right, this is not a good place to drill, it's too far deep or the terrain or whatever, then learn how to harvest water, rainwater, or learn how to create a water catchment system. You can do that. You and a couple of your buddies can do that, including making your own pond or making your own lake. These are basic life skills that I'm putting on the exact same level as a college degree in STEM, a bachelor's degree in STEM. That's just me. Call me crazy. Those two, learn how to build a dry cabin. See, if you know how to build a dry cabin, and you got water, you got everything. You got fundamentally, learn how to recognize and forage for food if you need to, because a forest is a virtual grocery store. You know, you got all kind of animals. You got all kind of mammals. You got all kind of reptiles. Can you imagine getting the food bill? Let's say you live in the city, and you got birds that are coming in, and, you know, they gather their food. You see them every day. And you got squirrels. Just imagine getting the food bill on a daily basis for the amount of food that the squirrels and the birds consume in your backyard. And that's what you can visibly see. Now, if you got trees in your front yard, you know, because once trees get to a certain level, you really don't even have to water them. Trees consume, look it up online yourself. Look how much water, groundwater, a tree consumes in a day. Imagine you getting that bill. So nature, the forest, is a virtual grocery store. Even when it's cold out and you got snowy terrain out and whatever, you still see birds, you still see animals, the ones that are not hibernating, they have the intelligence and skill set to get food, to feed themselves, and to hydrate themselves. Modern man, on a critical mass basis, we don't have those skills. That's what I'm saying. I consider these skills, I call them off-the-grid skills, off-the-grid life skills that you basically need to know. And you do have people that are migrating that are picking up these skills, such as solar cooking. Now, what do you do? How do you eat your food? How do you cook a hot meal? Gas has been cut off your microwave or nothing like that. These are basic skills that I think people, see what the people on YouTube are doing. Like I said, that's one of the best barometers on the planet. Okay, let's see. Let me go to my studio. I'm not looking at my board people, so I don't know who's there, who's not there. Now, let me put this out there, too. Before you decide to move to the country or rural area, or buy your 40 acres and a mule. There's a very interesting show I just got turned on to it a couple of days ago titled Homestead Rescue. We want to do an urbanized TV version of it that will air on the web, YouTube, and Instagram. Homestead Rescue, this guy and his family, they live out of Alaska, but they go to various homesteads in the United States. Now, homesteads that they go to are homesteads of typically people who are city dwellers or suburbanites that said, you know, because during the pandemic, a lot of people say, you know what, I'm done with New York, I'm done with St. Louis, I'm done with Dubuque, Iowa, I'm going to buy me 20 to 40 acres, I'm going to buy me some acres out in a rural area, I'm a grid off the grid, I'm going to be done with these bills, these expenses, light bills and all this. But when they get out there, they find out real quick they don't have the skill set to live on this new land that they bought. Some give up and leave. Like, for instance, one of the basic skills that you need if you're going to live in a rural area is social capital. There's a black couple in El Paso County, Colorado right now. Hopefully I can get them on here. Now, I don't know the backstory of it, but they bought 1,000 acres of land. They should be commended on that. But they're having problems with their neighbor. That's a social capital, because social capital is a skill. And number two, the dispute, the social capital is going negative because of dispute over property lines. They have a case of adverse possession, but they renamed it, or let's say, I'm not going to put it on them. I'm going to say the press, the mainstream press, particularly the black press, has renamed it a racial problem. But at the root, they have a legal problem. It's called adverse possession. Adverse possession deals with disputes over boundary lines of land. That's that. Once they get past the racial stuff, they're going to have to come to grips with the origin of this is property boundary lines. But some kind of way they got steered away from the real problem, which was legal adverse possession, to they made it racial. And then other things have happened since then. I mean, when you don't have the social capital in place, but social capital, when you go rural, you need to be know your neighbors. Now, because if you're on 1,000 acres of land, you shouldn't even see your other neighbors unless you want to. Anyway, but on Homestead Rescue, this family out of Alaska, there's a father and his son and daughter, all adults. They go out and they basically educate people on what they need to get their homestead running. Now, the common denominator that I've seen the most, I've been binge watching them like for the last two nights and mornings, early mornings, is number one, water. Yeah, one guy that he's driving like every other day, or at least once a week. Let's put it once a week. He's driving 42 miles into the city at least once a week, 42 miles in, 42 miles back home to get water. Now, he's sitting on 20-plus acres of land. He's walking on water, groundwater, that is. He's driving on it. Matter of fact, you take the 20 acres. Let's say he's got 40 acres. He's got 40 acres of groundwater. Then he drives another 42 miles. We're walking on we're all existing on oceans of water. It just depends on how deep you want to go. But he didn't know nothing about that. So one of the things that they did, and they were, he and his wife were thinking about selling the 40 acres back. But they don't teach that. That's why I'm saying learning how to drill for water. It's three things when it comes to water. There's some skill sets within this. Number one, learn how to drill for water. That's a skill set. And within that skill set, that includes where to drill, how to determine this, and all this added up. Number two, how to harvest rainwater. You might live in some place like Arizona where it doesn't rain that much, even New Mexico. So you might have to learn how to set up a water catchment system. You can do a a catchment system where you can catch water during the rainy season in that particular neck of the woods and store it. I call that water banking, but that's all part of water catchment, that skill set. And then you're good for water the whole year round. The other phase of water catchment is you might have to learn how to construct your own pond and or lake on your own property. And part of that skill set is because if you build a pond or a lake, if you don't build it right or maintain it, it can leak. And then you don't have any water, and you're back to round zero again. You can also stock your lake or pond with food, fish, which is food. This is all under the – this is a skill set, people. So with and I highly recommend the show because I've been binge-watching. I'm going to binge-watch it some more this week – I mean tonight. Homestead Rescue. So, Andy, you'll see other things. But water, that's one of the big ones. That's one of the big ones on that program. So, and I call that's what I call that's an off-the-grid skill set. They're not they teach it in the Amish community. They teach it in much of the Mennonite community. They teach it in the Hutterite communities. But in mainstream public schooling, and mainstream, private schooling, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Stanford, there's no Bachelor of Science in everything I just talked about. I'm just saying. Water is very basic. If you're thinking about moving to the city, I mean moving from the city to an inexpensive area and building your own whatever, water, and then you also have to think about sanitation. And whatnot. So, okay, that's enough on that. And we'll go more into detail on another day on this stuff. Not ran overtime. It was started like really slow, so. In any event, let me take a call here. Oh, wait a minute. Pressed the wrong button. 314 area code. Your mic is open.
Elliot, when are you going to build your small home so I can come visit?
What's the date, the 14th or the 15th?
Today is 16th.
Today's the 16th? Yeah, you sure are right.
And when people move out to these remote areas, what are they going to do for employment?
Good question.
You know, some cities.
Some people, depending on what they do. Oh, wait a minute. Some people, depending on what they do, Some people might be fortunate enough to work remotely. That's some people. Some people, if you got a job at Walmart, you won't be able to do that. But there are many towns. I'll take Taft, Oklahoma, because I know that the best. In Taft, Oklahoma, which are rural townships in Oklahoma, and Tallahassee, that's another remote. They're not, you know, I wouldn't consider them remote. They're in the country. They're in rural areas. In those places, particularly Taft or Eaton Summit, a 15-minute drive, the 15 to 20-minute drive, you can go from Taft or Summit or Tallahassee, Oklahoma, into Muskogee. In Muskogee, there are plenty of places where you can work. Walmart, T-Mobile, Denny's. There's a bunch of hotels, motels, grocery stores, bowling alleys, anything that you can put this way. Anything that's in Tulsa, you can have in Muskogee, and Muskogee from Taft and those two other cities, it's a 15 to 20 minute drive. You're absolutely right, because
some municipalities are requiring that their retirees live in the city where they earn their money at, their retirement at, because they're saying that you have to recirculate those dollars in that community, their retirement money. So things are beginning to change.
You're quite right. Now that you, the one that, hold on, Bianca, the one that you just announced, because I'm just thinking about the three towns I just named. There's no places where, like, in Summit, Oklahoma, there's no places where there's no business in town other than the, you know, the three or four churches where you can circulate the money in that town.
Well, they probably don't have no municipal pension either.
Oh, no. Those places don't have that.
You got to have a lot of people paying into it.
Right.
Like,
they don't have that.
The police department has over 35,000 police officers. So that's a lot of people that's paying into it. Illinois has some towns in Illinois, or should I say Illinois State, has pension plans that's hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. I don't even know how they survive that.
No, you know, you're absolutely right. A place like a lot of these little towns that have a population of 100, 200, 300, 400 people, that's not enough to pay out a pension. You know, that's a good question. Next time I talk to some of these little small town mayors, I'm going to ask them about that.
Then you got to have services, for instance, like internet. I can't trade stocks out in the middle of Oklahoma because the latency of my internet connection just would not permit it. I never would get anything clear. So all these things come with a drawback. I don't know what to say. Maybe it's best just to be a hermit. But what's the use? The earth is going to come to an end here pretty, you know, sooner than later. And it'll all be gone. And by the way, the U.S. Constitution don't work when it comes to colonization of the planet. So these marches, no justice, no peace, and BLM, that stuff ain't going to work in those towns. They're going to tell them to go to hell. Well, actually, they're not going to even invite them.
Yeah, well, no argument there. You bring up a good point. At first, they probably will not be, and here's what I'm basing that on. Last year, I watched definitely three launches of Jeff Bezos, whatever his, you know, space company is called. I watched at least two or three of his launches where they went out in space momentarily. I think they had a black woman on one of those. I think one of those. And then with Sir Richard Branson, he went out into the space. But but in order to go into space, because that's going to become an emerging industry. I mean, they're booking tickets now for going to next flights into space. But we haven't got it together here on the planet Earth, right? So
exactly, they couldn't live in no confined space.
If we get to,
be no kill to each other,
right?
Playing loud music. Matter of fact, unless you bring it with you, it ain't gonna be no radio stations, no TV stations, right? No watching the NBA or the NFL games. That stuff don't exist.
Not
and the trip
space.
There takes years. And you can't come back.
Oh, you talking about the Mars. You talking about Mars.
Boy, that's one of the nearest
ones.
I'm just thinking about
book a ticket to get on Jeff Bezos' next flight into space, because they launch out there in West Texas. You know, that takes a few million dollars just to go up for a few minutes of that experience of flight into space. So I'm imagining they'll probably get a space station up there eventually, but I can't imagine right now there are too many blacks on the planet in a position. I mean, there might be there's only a handful of black billionaires anywhere on the planet.
Yeah, they ain't going up there. Then you're going to have a whole lot of black first. Just think, the first black man to get locked up on Mars. How does that sound? That'll go be in the CRT history books.
Before you get to that, you got to get them into Mars. You got to get them into the ship to get to Mars or even get into space. So, something that you said earlier.
There is no justice in these colonization plans that people are planning for and even putting things into effect for. No such thing as police brutality. They beat your ass, you're going to get your ass beaten out of space. So that's just the way it's going to be. I don't blame people for that.
We're not taking space trips on a critical mass base. We're nowhere near that yet. But one thing you did point
out. I have a friend I talked to.
Go ahead, I'm listening.
You know, periodically, she's white. She and her husband built. They live out in remote areas in Alaska, and. They had to just build a new place because the otters got in the old place and took it over and tore it up.
Okay.
No, they live out there. They're about 2 or 3 hours before you get to any civilization by road, and you can fly.
Yeah, a lot of people, they're not prepared now because. The places I name are not remote places. But to get into truly remote places like this family with Homestead Rescue, they live in a very remote place in Alaska, but they have the skill set to live there. I mean, because they're surrounded by grizzly bear or bears up there. As well as
a gallon of milk costs about $8, by the way.
Up in Alaska?
Loaf of bread,
yeah,
probably
Alaska,
about $5.
Well, they have to import a lot of stuff.
Absolutely.
But these people, like I say, they don't live in a populated area like that. I mean, if you live in Juneau, Nome, Fairbanks, you're going to be spending that $8 a gallon for milk. But these people, they have the skill set. And like I say, all people that, you know, you just got to decide how much comfort and convenience can you afford to have? You know. But some people, to pull them out of the city is not going to happen.
No, they would die. Like you said, you don't have the survival skills, no way in the world. They don't know how to hunt fish and things like that.
And mostly, a lot of people are addicted to, you know, the experience. I mean, some people love to buy Evian on water. That's what they love to do. They like to, you know, they're not thinking about drilling a well. They have no interest in that at all, and that's okay because everybody, you know, different strokes for different folks. So, in any event, tomorrow is Thursday. We will be back here at 10:30. I said we want to switch to 4:30. But tomorrow's Friday? Oh, man. Okay. We'll be here at the regular time. All right, then.
All right, I'll see you.
Okay, see you, Pianca. See you guys in the audience. Talk to you guys tomorrow.